Thanks everyone for coming to this last lecture after, you know, and last lecture of the day too. And this is more of a bonus lecture. You know, feel free to take notes or not take notes if you prefer not taking notes. But today I'm going to talk about my favorite topic, which I've avoided to this point, which are fermions, and talking about them for microscopic models and how we deal with them. And fermions here are going to help us in two ways. In fact, both ways will be related to the transverse field Ising model and its solution. But to do that, we need another tool first, which I've been told you haven't really seen yet. And so this is the second quantization for fermions. And it's about how do you study fermions in operator form in order to get quantum models and whatnot. And actually from this, these fermionic operators, which are for many fermionic particles, when you go to a path integral, you do get something that you've seen so far, which are Grassmann numbers. So these fermionic operators will take you to Grassmann numbers if you're looking at a path integral. And basically the second quantization for fermions is built on two simple operators, C dagger and C, with some subscript alpha. And this C dagger alpha, what it does on states is it creates a particle with property alpha. And this could be, it really depends on what you're looking at, but it could be something like a site, you know, maybe it creates a particle at a particular site, or it could be a momenta, if you're talking about momentum space, could be angular momenta, various things. And so this, before we had no particle with this particular property, we operate on a state, and now we have a particle with that property. And then this one is the opposite. It annihilates a particle with that property. And so those are the operators and what are our states? Well, if we want to think about the Hilbert space, in this case, it's actually called a Fock space because in the Hilbert space, we had a certain number of particles and they could move around and change, but we didn't create and destroy particles. So the Fock space is just an extension of that where we have different numbers of particles. And so one can start with the vacuum state that you could just represent as a zero. But the point is, you know, if we, and I'm going to think in terms of sites right now, but we could think in terms of other properties too. But this zero would really be something like zero particles at any of the sites. You know, maybe this is site one, this is site two, etc. And these are really then going to be all small small spaces that correspond to those sites. So this would be something like this Kronecker product of, you know, site one, zero particle there, zero particle at site two, up to zero particles at site n. And so I'll use zero as a shorthand for the vacuum, but really keep in mind it's saying, hey, there's nothing anywhere. And then from there, what you would find is that if you had an annihilation operator and you acted on the vacuum, Well, that's saying here I want to destroy a particle at site I. But there already is no particle at site I. So the action of an annihilation operator when there's no particle there is going to be zero entirely. So now we don't have a state, we just have zero. And then if you have a creation operator instead on site I, then that gives you, we still have zero at site one. Let's assume site I wasn't site one. I'm just writing this schematically. But then one of these sites, site I, is going to go from zero to one here. And then there's zero at all of the other sites. So these are the operators, and these are going to be our building blocks to build Hamiltonians from them. And so the first thing I want to note is we can make an operator from these that measures the number of particles that are at a site. So this is called the occupation number operator. And for this right now, I'm going to assume a one site system just for simplicity. And so for this, we can define this operator, which we usually denote with this n hat, as equal to C dagger C. And since it's one site, I'm going ahead and not giving it an index because I'm just saying, hey, there's only one site in the whole world here. So there's only one thing you can create. And so then if you take this occupation number operator and let's just say we act it on zero where there are zero sites, well, that is the same as this. And from what I've just told you, what is this going to be equal to?
Zero.
Yes. So this is equal to zero, or you could say it's equal to then zero times the zero state. On the other hand, if I operate on a state where there is a particle, well, that's the same as first I have the operator, and then I'm going to have the state one, which means I created a particle on the vacuum. So that's what state one is. And then, and we'll get into some commuting properties in a moment. But for now, if we just think in a simple way, we think, well, if we create a particle, but then we destroy that particle, but then we create it again, we should get just one again. So at least in terms of thinking about what these operators should do, it makes sense that this occupation number operator is going to behave in this way and basically tell you how many particles of a particular type. So you can then extend this to many particles, and then you'd have an Ni operator, and it would tell you how many Ni's exist there. And notice I just stopped at 0 and 1 because we are dealing with fermions. So you cannot have more than one fermion per single particle state, basically. And there are operators in the second quantization for bosons too, but I'm only going to focus on fermions today. And they have similar properties, but of course different, so that you can allow more than one per state. And just as a note, if you want to get to the path integral, like I mentioned, you can define a particular type of state. I don't know what symbol you used for Grassmann numbers. Did you use psi's or did you use eta's or something? Does anyone remember?
Thetas.
Thetas, okay. So I'll just use those so that you can keep it in mind. But you can define a special type of state called a coherent state, where if you operate on that state with the C operator, you get a number theta. And so this is a Grassmann coherent state. I'm not going to talk about this more today, but there's a way then you can write identities using these states, and this is basically the path you would take to get from a microscopic model to a continuum sort of field theory that involved Grassmann numbers.
So is this Grassmann the same thing that we learned from QFT, the Grassmann variable?
Exactly. That's
how is it connected to describing a state?
So this is a state where it's saying, hey, the eigen, it's an eigenstate of the C operator, and its eigenvalue is going to be a Grassmann number. So there's a way to build this.
Basically. It doesn't quite describe the number. Okay. I see.
Yeah, so. Okay, and then there's another key thing I need to say that I hinted at when I was thinking about this particle number operator, fermions obey the Pauli exclusion principle. So you would have that if you have C dagger and then another C dagger, well, you're trying to create this. In fact, I can go ahead and add an index to these now. You're trying to create the same particle twice in a row. So that should actually be zero. And then also, if you have CI, you removed one particle at site I, but now you're removing a second particle at site I. And that's impossible for fermions. You can't have two or more. So this one is also equal to zero. And then what you also have is that, like I said, the n values, if I'm just thinking about the number of particles that can be in a state, we know that's an element of 0 and 1. The same is going to be true for 1 minus n, then. That is also an element of 0 or 1, because, you know, you put in a 0 or 1 here, and you still get 0 or 1. And so you can also argue, similarly to what I had here, that that 1 minus n, so basically measuring the number of particles that are not there, that will be equal to C dagger. And you have that n plus 1 minus n is equal to 1. So you get another relation, which is that C dagger C plus C dagger is equal to 1. And we give a special name to this type of relationship. If you notice, it kind of looks like a commutator, you know, one thing minus the other thing in the opposite order, except it uses a plus sign instead of a minus sign. And so what we often use, so there are different notations. The one I often use is these curly braces, which are an anti-commutator, and that is a symbol saying, hey, when you have this one times this one plus them in the other order, what you get is 1. And so from there, you get some general commutation relations that really fully define how these operators work. And that is C alpha anti-commutator with C alpha prime is equal to C alpha dagger, C alpha prime dagger all of these are equal to zero all the time. But then if you have C alpha prime dagger, these are equal to a Kronecker delta, depending on whether alpha and alpha prime are equal to each other. Because when they're equal, you get this situation right here. And I will just also note the occupation number, which is C alpha dagger, C alpha. So these are what you can use to define fermions in a many-body context when you have these microscopic models. For bosons, you get something that looks very similar to this. The difference is these are all standard commutators rather than anti-commutators. Okay, so let's return to our friend, the transverse field Ising model from yesterday. Where it was defined using a coupling with the ij nearest neighbors times sigma zi, sigma zj, minus g times the summation over all sites, sigma I in the x direction. And to recall from before, we are going to have a quantum phase transition. So if we put ourselves at t equals zero and we look at the g coupling, then when g is small, we're going to have, and again, let's just think about in the z direction. Think in z direction. And so then in this side, when g is small, we're going to have the ferromagnet, where, you know, we can have the sites up, or we can have the sites all down. But then as we go over here, we get the paramagnet. And in that case, if all of the spins are aligned in the x direction, from the perspective of z, really it's going to look like all possible up-down combinations. And that comes from the fact that sigma x is equal to sigma plus sigma minus over 2. Yeah, so you can see this term is just going to take all the spins and flip them every which way from the z perspective. Okay, so the reason why I spent all this time with fermions is it turns out that this model, just like for the scalar, classical Ising model, that was solvable in 1 plus 1D exactly. This is also exactly solvable in 1 plus 1D. And you can do that by actually using these fermions. So the fermions can help you out here. And the way that they help you out is with what's called a Jordan-Wigner transformation. And so the way that the Jordan-Vigner transformation works is we are working with quantum spins, and they have, in the Z basis, they have two orientations, up or down. What the Jordan-Vigner transformation asks us to do is to think of a spin up as a site that is unoccupied. And then a spin down as a site that is occupied. And then what it does is it gives us a mapping and some expressions of these operators in terms of fermionic operators instead. So the sigma iz, this one is going to be the simplest one, and it is 1 minus 2 n. And the reason why it's this is if you imagine, if you have an unoccupied thing, then you're going to put a 0 there. So then what do you get here? So if n is 0, because there's no particle there, then what does this whole expression say? Yeah, 1. So it's going to be 1 for unoccupied. On the other hand, if you do have a particle here, then this n operator is going to give us a 1. So what does this expression give us?
1.
Yeah. So then we're going to get minus 1 for an occupied. And so you see that, so you see when I have an occupied with a down arrow, I get minus 1. If I have an unoccupied, which I associate with an up arrow, I get plus 1. So I'm getting that sigma z behavior again with these fermions by mapping it to that. So that's the first one. Now the next one is thinking about sigma plus. We split these into sigma plus and sigma minus here, because we know we can express sigma x then ultimately in terms of the sigma plus and the sigma minus. And so sigma plus, well, sigma plus we know with the spins would take a down spin to an up spin. So with fermions, we want it to take an occupied fermion to an empty fermion. So then what should this sigma plus be associated with for the fermions? Because it goes down to up. And then if we think in the fermion picture, we want it to go from occupied to unoccupied. Yes, the C operator. We're going to destroy the particle at C if there was a particle there. And then I actually put it over here because there is a complicated aspect to this, and that is we get a string of these kind of operators that can be plus or minus. And the reason that we have these is because if we think about the spins that we had originally, the spins, and when they're in different sites, they will commute with each other. But the fermions anti-commute. So if we're looking at a system, the fermions are going to anti-commute and introduce extra signs. And so this introduces extra signs to compensate the wrong signs from the fermions.
Sorry, it's hard to see from back here. What's inside the bracket?
Yeah, let me rewrite that because I didn't put this far enough to one side. Okay. So if I have the CI over here, then in the bracket, I'm going to have a product of j is less than I. And so remember, this is a 1D lattice. So this will, think of this as all the sites to the left of whatever your eyesight is on the 1D lattice. And then you're going to have 1 minus 2 nj. And so these are a bunch of factors that can be plus or minus. And so these are sine factors to get rid of anti-commutation signs. And this is something that one can actually do in higher dimensions as well. The thing is, it gets even more complicated because this is a 1D lattice. So if I have a line of sites and I'm thinking about site I, then I just take all the sites to the left of it and I include operators for those sites. But as you get to higher dimensions, you can do some similar things, but you're going to have to do a snake type of thing where you include all the sites up to a particular site. And there are many ways that you can define a Jordan-Vigner transformation, many ways you can compensate this, but you have to do it in some sort of systematic way, basically. And it just turns out very nicely in 1D. But there are some 2D systems, like the Kitaev model, where you can do stuff like that too, and it ends up working out. Okay. And then finally, we have sigma I minus. And then sigma I minus, we know, would take us from an up spin to a down spin. And so that is going to take us from an unoccupied site to an occupied site. So what type of operator do we associate with that? In terms of the fermions.
C dagger?
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have a CI dagger, and then we have our product of j is less than I of 1 minus 2nj. And the same logic here, this will compensate the issue with the anti-commutation signs so that we can really preserve the original relations for the bosons. And I will say, note here then, this preserves the commutators where, you know, if you have sigma I plus, sigma I minus, and commute them, you have the Kronecker delta ij, sigma iz. Sigma iz commuting with sigma j. Oh, this should be a j here. Sigma j plus or minus equals plus or minus 2 Kronecker delta ij. Sigma I plus or minus. And this is something that you could confirm on your own, but it's kind of an annoying thing to do, but you can do it and then you can confirm. Okay, and this is something that people use a lot of times in studying quantum matter or other microscopic systems. You will often change variables and look at things in terms of different type of operators because things might be more illuminating there. And then there's an idea of sort of quasi-particles because you can always define these new types of creation annihilation operators, and if something looks nice in that that language, then maybe the system is better thought of physically in terms of these new particles, these quasi-particles, where things look more straightforward. So then you can write the Hamiltonian in terms of these things now. And when you do that in 1D, it amazingly ends up being local still, because there was no like reason a priori where you'd go, okay, this is definitely going to be local, because there are all these non-local things that are string operators for various other sites. But it actually still ends up being limited to the nearest neighbors. So you get various combinations of CI dagger, nearest neighbors, then CI for nearest neighbors, and then CI dagger for nearest neighbors, and then I shouldn't say I each time. C dagger C for nearest neighbors. And then something happens. Yeah, then we have the boundary. I'm not going to write it out because it's not too important here, but you could figure it out. It's basically the same thing, but with a minus one to the NF factor. And then there's also the transverse field piece, because this piece is your nearest neighbors for with J. And then this piece is the transverse field, which I decided to use G for some reason. I should have used H, but this G field is the same as the H field as before. 1 minus 2ni. And you know, this one is pretty straightforward. You can see it immediately because we already said the sigma z's were 1 minus 2n. So this is just a, sorry, yeah. Oh, okay. So this is an extra step. This is, so one of the things that you can do is you can rotate and you can write this model in this way. This is another trick you do in order to solve it in 1 plus 1D. And so we're going to think about this really from the, thinking about this in the X direction now. And then, well, we're still thinking about it in the Z direction, but we're going to use these relations and put these in sigma X and this one in sigma Z. So this really was step one, using the Jordan-Vigner transformation. Now step two is using another familiar tool that that we've used to help us in this course, and that is now go to momentum space. And this is a trick for a lot of these exactly solvable models. Oftentimes we get to sort of an almost diagonal state when we go to momentum space. And so momentum space operators for the C dagger and C are going to be very straightforward, where we actually just use the same definitions we used in class because we already learned those for generic operators. So we are going to sum over k, the discrete momenta, because we have a finite discrete lattice. So we have c times e to the I k xi. And then we have a ci dagger equals 1 over the square root of n times k C dagger k e to the minus I k xi. And so we write these operators now in terms of the momentum operators instead. And what we get when we do that is we actually have something that already looks almost diagonal. We can write it in terms of these new vector operators, because I'm gonna, it's really a new set of creation and annihilation operators that now have two indices, k and alpha. Alpha can be one or two. And so for every k, there are going to be two of these operators. And then we have h sub k, alpha, alpha prime, k, alpha prime. And you might say, how do we get two of these? And that's because here I'm going to say that k is greater than zero. So I'm going to take half of my momentum here and write it in this way. And what I get, what these psi's actually are, when we go into momentum space, is the sum over, say, k greater than zero, alpha, alpha prime. And then I have a vector involving ck dagger, c minus k. And then I have a 2x2 matrix of 2g minus 2j cosine of ka. And then 2ij sine of ka. And then again, should be minus 2ij sine of ka. And then 2g minus 2j cosine of ka. I think that one is minus. It's not going to make a difference for the eigenvalues, but I think this one was minus of that one. I don't remember completely. I'll give a reference that gives you the steps of this. Ck and then c dagger minus k minus g n. And so that is step two. We go to momentum space using these operators. We put them into this Hamiltonian in the fermions, and we get this. And really, this is perfect. This is all we need in order to get the energy eigenvalues, because for a given k now, we have this simple matrix that we can use to get the energy eigenvalues from it. And so one can diagonalize the matrix. You can also find the eigenvectors, and from those eigenvectors, you can build single particle states. Yeah, go ahead.
So what does alpha mean in this?
Yeah, alpha is just a second index that I'm giving this. And so alpha, so basically psi dagger alpha equals one would be this one, and then psi dagger alpha equals two would be this one. So I'm writing this thing in terms of a vector form up there, basically. So step three, we get eigenvalues for single particle states. And basically that means we can diagonalize this matrix, get the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors, and we will end with H equals the sum over the K greater than zero of some energy times some new particle This is after we've found what the eigenvectors are, and we're going to write it in terms of new operators that truly diagonalize this matrix. And then we're going to have plus the single particle integer at minus k times the operators for the minus k's. And then we find that this single particle energy or single particle state with this momentum operator k, depending on whether it's plus or minus k, will give you plus or minus this number here, where I have g minus j cosine of ka quantity squared plus j squared times sine squared ka. And you can sort of see where this would come from. You know, you see the elements up here, and you know, you would take this minus epsilon, this minus epsilon, take the determinant, set it equal to zero, solve for epsilon, and this is the type of thing you would get for the energies. And I call these single particle energies because what you have is you have n particles where each one has an operator associated with it. And it will create a particle with the energy Ek. So this creates a particle with energy Ek. And so this is one of the trickier things at first, thinking about the second quantization. You diagonalize it at the end, and you think, okay, I should have the answer. But then it's like, how do you get the answer from this expression? And so the point is, with these particles, we have d dagger k's and d dagger minus k's. And so that means half of the particles have plus single particle energies, and half of them have minus single particle energies. So if I were to draw these single particle energies, they'd basically look like, if I'm at zero, for the smaller lattices, they're more far apart from each other. And then as we get more momenta, the single particle energies will get closer to each other. And as we get more and more momenta, as we have more and more lattice sites and we go to the infinite lattice, they will get even closer to each other. So this is the lattice size increases. And if we're thinking about how to get the ground state for this, well, how would you get a ground state for the system, do you think? Because you can make as many particles you want, you know, with the various energies. The ground state should be the lowest total energy that you could have. So what are you going to do? And so this really is something that, where you're working with the grand partition function, you could have as many particles or as few as you want. You could have, maybe the ground state has one particle in it, or maybe it has all of the particles in it. But knowing this, knowing the energy structure where half of them are negative, half of them are positive, how do you minimize the energy total from the single particle energies?
You fill in all the negative energies.
Exactly. So we are going to create all of the particles with minus k. With the creation operator for minus k. And so then the ground state energy is going to just be the sum when k is less than zero of all these single particle energies, the sum, well, I'll just keep k greater than zero since that's a convention we used before, but of all those single particle energies for minus k, because all of those, using our equation up here, were negative. So this is E ground. It's going to be the sum of all those single particle energies for the minus k particles. And so the point is, and this is as far as I'll go, we want to be able to find the critical g for this quantum phase transition. And so we know that the GC is going to occur when we have a level crossing or an avoided level crossing. And in this case, it turns out to be an avoided level crossing. Because what one would find when G is equal to GC is that there's some location where the first level and then the next level will touch each other. And we can actually see it from the single particle energies. Because the one that we will care about is the one that is very close to zero, but just a little bit negative. Because if we think about when we go to the continuum, if we have a single particle energy equal to zero, that causes a degenerate ground state. Now, does anyone have an idea of why if one of these single particle energies were equal to zero, why would we then get a degenerate ground state? Thinking about how we build up the ground state.
Wouldn't the lines just touch and then you get intersection at the top and bottom ones?
Yeah, because we're building up the ground state with all the negative energies. And if we had a positive energy, that definitely would make the state higher. So we wouldn't add that. But if we had a zero energy, we could add it or we could not add it, right? So now we have a ground state that could include that particle or not include that particle. So we get a degenerate ground state at that point. So ground state could include EK equals zero or not, or lowest energy, because then the ground state is degenerate. And so this tells us we have a degenerate ground state, And once we get the degenerate ground state, that's where we have the level crossing, and that's where we have the phase transition, the quantum phase transition. And actually, I will want this one. And so then the way that you find the quantum critical point is basically solve epsilon k equal to zero. So solve, look at where this thing is equal to zero. And then it turns out that that really is only going to occur, can only occur for an infinite lattice. With G equal to J. And the reason for that is this cosine, it ranges from plus one to minus one. And so if the J is smaller than the G, then these could never cancel and give a zero. And if it's larger, then there is an intersection point, but then this part messes it up. And so what we can only get this when n goes to infinity. And so then this is how you find the critical coupling for a quantum phase transition, and for this example, for the 1D quantumizing model. And I think this is a good time for a break, and I'm happy to take questions on this.
Mm-hmm. I don't really understand the whole idea of like filling in the ground states, because it just seems like something we kind of do for no reason.
Yeah. So remember, we have like any number of particles. And so we also have that E minus K is less than zero and EK is greater than zero. That's an important observation to make from this stuff. And then we also have D dagger K and DK, D dagger minus K. And we know we can only have one particle for each of these plus Ks or minus Ks. For the fermions. And then the ground state should be the lowest possible energy we could possibly have. And so we will get that by creating all the particles that would add negative energies to our system. So that is actually going to be exactly half of the particles, and that's going to be all of the minus K particles. In fact, you can even write like the ground state is equal to just the product over the k's, where you have d dagger minus k acting on the vacuum. So this is creating all the particles up to, you know, zero and then stopping there, because then those would be positive energies on the other side and they would be making the energy, the total energy, larger.
Why is that the ground state? Why?
Because the ground state is the lowest possible energy you can get in your system.
But seem to have just covered up the other lower energies.
Oh, but remember, they add to each other. So what you're doing is that the total energy is equal to the sum of all of these individual energies. So you have a negative number, negative 2, and then you add negative 4 to it, and then you add negative 6 to it. If you didn't have any, if you left out even one of those, you wouldn't have as negative number as you had before. So let's see, let's say we have E1, E2, E3, E-1, E-2, E-3. And then these are just equal to 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. And so if you create particles, we have 6 particles we could create, and they have all these energies. So how do we create a set of particles that have the lowest possible energy? What we would want to do is if we create, let's say -1, -2, -3 on the vacuum, then the total energy is going to equal to -1,
oh, right,
-2, -3, -6. And -6 is the smallest possible number we can get from all of these. And so that's really the idea. If you have fermions and you solve your problem, that's how you build up your ground state, by just adding up all the negative energies.
Mm-hmm. They assume that G and J are positive.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, G and J are positive.
Because the G equals minus J is also a solution, but I guess you're not looking at like...
Yeah, yeah, you're right, you're right. There's a symmetry here too. We could look at this and get the same thing in the other direction. I agree.
Mm-hmm. So why does a zero only occur for n and it goes to infinity?
Yeah, because what you want is you want this to be equal to exactly 1, and so then this needs to be exactly pi over 2. This one needs to be exactly 0. This one needs to be exactly pi over 2. And so only in the continuum do you reach that exact k value. Otherwise, because remember, your k here is going to be discretized. And for a finite number of sites, it's always discrete values. So just never quite reaches the right value. It gets close, and it gets closer and closer the larger and larger your lattice is.
Mm-hmm. So how are the D operators and C operators are related?
Yeah. So you know how the CI operators and the CK operators are related from those equations up there. Now you have this matrix. And so just as I found the eigenvalues, I didn't write them down, but you can also find the eigenvectors. And that allows you to get new combinations of CK and C minus K that will define your D operators at that point. And so the D operators are combinations of CK and C minus K. And those came from the eigenvectors if you diagonalize.
So you just find the eigenvector.
Yeah, so you'll get a new transformation, and you ultimately, you know, you have this whole series of transformations. I mean, that's a lot of these exactly solvable models. That's the type of thing you have to do. You keep transforming things until it looks like this, you know, where you've got this Hamiltonian that I didn't circle, but in terms of the D operators. And I often just use D at the end because it's like, oh, these are the diagonalizing operators. We finally ended with an operator that tells us about basically these quasi-particles now that have these energies. And it's a very simple system at that point.
Okay. Mm-hmm. D operators kind of describe quasi-particles that are...
Yes.
Kind of transformed fermions.
Yeah, yeah. We can ultimately think of this quantumizing model as a fermionic system where you have N fermions, each one has a single particle energy, and when you create them, that's its energy. And the energy of this original system is just going to be the sum of the energies of those particles. So, because you can create, you know, this is the ground state, this one is special, but you've got a full Fock space that can have any number of particles that you have, and then any combinations of your Ks and minus Ks. So there's a large space there. But we're only interested in the ground state since we're interested in the quantum phase transition.
So the system is sort of described by like a fermion on a line that is evolving in time. Is that it? Like a time evolution?
Well, there are many fermions actually. So they're still like, and yeah, you don't really learn much. I guess you don't. It's not as obvious from this picture what the physics of it is, you know, because these are the energies, but it's quite clear how to get the ground state from this. So you have this ground state, and then you could rewrite this in terms of your original C operators. And you could actually rewrite it then in terms of your original sigmas, you know, your spin operators from the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Do we want this condition to be true for all K?
So what we need is we need a crossing place, and so as long as there is a K where it happens, then because remember, these are this is just saying there is some epsilon k equal to zero, and that means you could include that particle or you could not include that particle. So that's a degenerate ground state at that point. And so that's also represented by these single particle energies.
Okay, but then if I set k equals to zero, mm-hmm. in this, and j equals g, it looks like it's satisfied.
Well, there isn't a k equals zero exactly. I mean, depending, so the way we would set this up with our labs, there wouldn't be a degeneracy from the beginning, so.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's not about k equal to zero anyway. I think that's about k equal to pi over 2. That's the one we're approaching here. Right? No, wait. I'm getting confused again. Wait. When is sine of zero equal to zero? Okay. So yeah, it is k equal to zero.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And that the crystal momentum k equals zero is like the origin.
Yes.
Reciprocal lattice. So it should always be there. It's always a Fourier associated to a Fourier.
It's not always there. It depends on the dimension, like how many sites you have in your lattice. Oh. In fact, the zero modes complicate how we think about it. So usually we avoid those.
Mm-hmm. So what does physically happen at the when there's degenerate ground state?
What physically happens?
Yeah, is it just phase transition? But
yeah, so there's the phase transition, and that's what we were talking about yesterday. So the gap between the ground state and the second excited state goes to zero. And remember, the gap was related, so it was gap is related to G minus GC to the z nu, and we had a critical exponent associated with it there. And so we get all of the same sorts of things that we would see with the finite temperature phase transitions. We would have universality there and whatnot. And then we learned also we could map it onto a finite temperature phase transition as well yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it physically observable? Physical phenomena.
Yeah, because if you look at observables, what you would find is that the correlation length of them would go infinite at that point. So you can look at all the observables in the same way you would do for finite temperature. The susceptibility would blow up at that point, and the various other things would happen just as we would see before. Okay, and so then briefly I'm going to tell you, because I think we've built up all this background, and I'm not going to talk too much about it, but it'll allow you to understand this idea of the fuzzy sphere that I mentioned. And for this one, we are going to think about the transverse field Ising model in 2 plus 1D. So I was talking about it in 1 plus 1D before. This fuzzy sphere ends up being a technique that works well for it, and we were particularly interested in 2 plus 1D, and I'll speak about that and the reasons for that in a moment. So one of the things is, in 1 plus 1D, we get emergent, right at the critical point, we get additional symmetries. And that's often the case with these transitions. In this case, we get emergent conformal symmetry. And conformal symmetry, you'll have a course on this later on too if you're interested in it, about CFTs, but it's a highly symmetric family, basically. It includes rotations, translations, dilations, and these special conformal transformations. And it turns out in 1 plus 1D, all you need to guarantee conformal symmetry is you need scale invariance at your fixed point. And so it's known for these, for relativistic phase transitions at 1 plus 1D fixed points, that you always have this emergent conformal symmetry. It's not known in 2 plus 1D. So emergent conformal symmetry. And so one of the questions is, how can we check for this symmetry? Because there are many things to check for. It's a large thing. And the other question really is that, as I mentioned, since, and I'll go ahead and mention what they are. Rotations, translations, dilatation, and special conformal. The other thing is, because it's so highly symmetric there, it actually places a lot of constraints on the type of energy spectrum you would have if you have this conformal symmetry. So all this symmetry forces particular structure on the theory. And what do I mean by that? Well, thinking about the general form of quantum phase transitions from before, where we have some kind of energy gap, we have a critical coupling, and we know in general, when we're looking at quantum phase transitions, that we find a quantum phase transition when the gap goes to zero. However, we can actually learn something additional from this gap if we have emergent conformal symmetry. So if we can simulate the system on a sphere, and this is the funny thing. I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but just to motivate it, if we can simulate it on a sphere and there is conformal symmetry, it turns out we can find, let me lift this up more. we can find critical exponents like eta and nu from energy gaps too. So not only will the energy gaps tell you about where to find the phase transition, but they also will give you information about these critical exponents that we learned about. And so you can certainly still get them by using the correlation functions that we used before, but you can also simply get them from the energy spectrum directly. And that really comes from all the structure that this conformal symmetry has imposed on the theory.
Emily? Mm-hmm. In principle, you can simulate this on like a 2D lattice.
Mm-hmm.
Just by identifying like the spherical boundary conditions, right?
So you can simulate it on, you're talking about how do you simulate this on a sphere, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that. Because the thing is, if you simulate it the conventional way on a lattice with periodic boundary conditions and whatnot, as you go to the continuum, you're not going to get a sphere, you're going to get a torus. And you can still have emergent symmetry, emergent conformal symmetry there, but you won't get this special property where eta and nu are related to the energy gaps. And that special property is called the state operator correspondence. And that, when you simulate it on a sphere, is a special, it's an if and only if. If you have conformal symmetry, you will see this this information in the energy gaps. And also, if you see this information in the energy gaps, that means you have conformal symmetry. But a numerical simulations on spherical surfaces are hard. And the reason is if you take your standard lattice approach that we would have, where we have periodic boundaries, so if we go off one side, that takes us back to the other side. Then you've probably seen sometimes mathematicians will do this. They show you how if you wrap something around, and then if you wrap it around again, what you get is a torus. And so what you would get in the continuum here is actually a geometry that's a torus rather than a sphere from this standard lattice. And that's fine. I mean, we can still get the critical exponents that way in the conventional way, but we would not be able to see a signature of conformal symmetry using this thing, which is called the state operator correspondence. And that is really where you can get these energy gaps, which I'll put them as a note. One of them is called delta sigma for one of the types of energy gaps in the spectrum. And that's related to your eta exponent. Another one is called delta epsilon. And that one you can get your nu from. And these are just both energy gaps from different states with the right symmetries. Thank you. So how do we do this? And here's where I will introduce a new type of fermionic operators to go with our theme of the day.
Sorry, it's not clear to me yet. So what if I have boundary conditions where if I go left, I come out on top, and similarly, if I go right, I come out on the bottom? That would be a spherical boundary condition.
There are people who have done this. People are very interested in being able to view this state operator correspondence. So people have actually put this on different geometries that have some of the rotational symmetry. But you're always breaking some of the rotational symmetry. And it basically amounts to you have to keep adding counter terms in order to get appropriate things as you're going to the continuum limit. And so it hasn't been all that successful, is the issue.
Mm-hmm. So I know that in 2D, one maps the theory on the sphere to like a theory on the cylinder, and like changes the signature. Mm-hmm. So to which surface do we map the three-dimensional sphere here?
So right now, this is a two-dimensional sphere. So I'm only thinking about the space, and then the time dimension is separate from that. So what this would go to is basically the torus cross R still for the time dimension.
Cylinder cross R or torus cross R?
This one is going to be the torus cross R.
Okay.
Okay, and so the solution is, well, what came to be known as the fuzzy sphere, which I'll get to that, but was first thought of as a spherical Landau level regularization. So it's a new type of way to regulate that's different from the lattice, because you start out with different aspects of the continuum compared to if you have a lattice. It was motivated by a phenomenon in condensed matter physics, where if you have a magnetic monopole, so, you know, this is, again, this is some theoretical object that we're working with as our regulator. So it doesn't matter whether it exists or not. It's just saying if we had a magnetic monopole, the physics that we would get is the following. So we could write down the Hamiltonian of this magnetic monopole. And what we would get is a quantum Hall effect here. But it's on a sphere. So this is the magnetic monopole. We have B fields going out. And then we have our particles on the surface of the sphere. And what this says, basically, is that due to this quantum Hall effect, we get a highly degenerate energy spectrum. Where you have some En, so this is a particular energy level in your spectrum, and that's equal to n times n plus 1 plus 2n plus 1 times s over 2m r squared. And then this s is just the strength of your magnetic monopole. The flux from the monopole. So then the stronger the magnetic monopole you have, the more degeneracies that you're going to have here. So if we think about the Landau levels, you'd have the energy of the lowest Landau level. So we can say LLL for lowest Landau level. And that's going to be some delta. There's going to be some gap between it and the next energy. So let's see. We have n equals 0, and we're going to have 2s plus 1 states in this lowest energy. For n equals 1, we're going to get 2 plus 2s plus 1 states. Because that was the other thing I missed out on here with these energies. The degeneracy of these energies is 2n plus 2s plus 1. So there are 2n plus 2s plus 1 copies of each of these energies. And so then the larger our S, the more flux we have through our monopole, the more identical energies we'll have. And so you can see here where I'm showing the spectrum. And then we'd have N equals 2, 4 plus 2S plus 1. And then the idea to realize the Ising model here is one of projecting. So what we're going to do now is we will introduce an H Ising Hamiltonian where we set the scales so that the gap from the lowest Landau level to H Ising, compared to the scales in H Ising, the gap is going to be much larger. So then our system will have only 2s plus 1 states. So basically, we are going to live in this lowest Landau level space. We have the Hamiltonian for the lowest Landau level, but it's degenerate. So it's going to add the same number on to all of these states of energy. So just as I mentioned, when we add a constant to a Hamiltonian, it doesn't change the physics. Meanwhile, H Ising will be so much lower that there's no way for particles to excite up to higher states. And so all the physics of interest will be the physics we want, but because we're going to live in this lowest Landau level. And the Hilbert space that we're working with has only 2s. Those 2s plus 1, they were degenerate states, but when we add H Ising, they won't be degenerate anymore. Okay, and so then what we would get is we would introduce new fermionic operators, because we have a lowest Landau level wave function, which is given by monopole harmonics, which we can write in terms of continuous variables. And so these are related to the spherical harmonics. They're called monopole harmonics. And then we can define some new creation annihilation operators. So psi of theta phi equals m equals minus s to s of phi m star cm. And so this would be annihilating a particle with a particular angular momentum value, but we are projecting into the lowest Landau level. So we use these wave functions to define new operators that live in the continuum. And so then similarly, we have psi dagger of theta phi equals the sum from m equals minus s to s of phi m cm dagger. And I should include the hats on these. I sometimes forget because I often leave them off anyway when I'm writing these operators a lot. And so then from there, we can have a fermion occupation where the fermion occupation number is simply going to be, well, the psi dagger psi. And so that gives us this sum. And so if you see your C dagger C, just as we were talking about before, this is our new fermion occupation number, and it's defined in continuous space. And then the key for why this is called a fuzzy sphere is that if you take the fermion occupation number at one set of angles, you'll find at one position in space on your sphere, you'll find that it does not actually commute with the fermion occupation number at another position on your sphere. And this is unusual. For fermionic operators in general, the two occupation numbers, they should commute with each other. But for this type of discretization, we aren't truly in the continuum because we're working in continuous space, but we still only have 2s plus 1 states in the continuous space. So what we are doing is we are approaching the continuum in a different way from on the lattice. So we always have continuous space, but the angular momentum of your states is still limited. And so that leads to strange consequences, like these operators that don't commute with each other. And that's what it's called, a fuzzy sphere, if you have things that don't commute with each other on the sphere. So basically out of time, so I'm not going to give the model itself, but basically you're going to build the Ising model, the Ising-like model, using these operators. And so, you know, you're going to have a Z times a Z, and then you're going to have a transverse field, an X. And you can check the paper, and I'll put a reference to it in the portal. But I wanted to quickly show you the data where we could see this state operator correspondence. So if I could get the projector down, that would be great. Okay, but basically, and the statistical physics lecture is now apparently. if you think about the symmetries of the model, this is an example of how in the UV, or in the in an example of this lattice-like model, we have one set of symmetries. And then as we go to the continuum, we will get the continuum symmetries that we want in the IR. And this is a mapping out of the phase diagram. So we do have a transverse field, and we'll be going from the ferromagnet to the paramagnet. And this is sort of a representation of what we call the orbital degrees of freedom, because we have these operators that have angular momenta. And so this would be the ferromagnetic side, where they could be aligned in either direction, and then we go to the paramagnet. And when we look at the energy levels themselves as we get to the critical point, well, this side shows things using a more conventional finite size scaling. So we look at the order parameter, which is the magnetization. That's what that m squared is. And what we would do is we know that the magnetization should scale according to this delta, which in this case means delta sigma, which corresponds to the eta critical exponent. And so if we take the ratio of the magnetization to how the magnetization should scale using that delta sigma, we find a very good crossing as we go up in systems. And so this is a way of finding your critical point. And it's also an evidence, and there are other ways to do finite size scaling in a more rigorous way to obtain that, extract that eta. But this is evidence that the eta is the eta for the Ising model, because while the delta sigma that corresponds to that eta is 0.518. On the other hand, this data is coming from the energy spectrum itself. And we do that by looking at gaps of the energy states that have the same symmetries as our magnetization operator. And so this is also telling us about the eta, and it's actually also giving us a very strong evidence of conformal symmetry, because what conformal symmetry says with the state operator correspondence is that this first gap gives you your eta, but then you should have many other gaps according to the symmetries of the states that are just a spacing of either exactly one or a spacing of exactly two. And so this is called a conformal multiplet. And this is a very specific way that the energy spectrum will look when you have conformal symmetry. So this is an example of, from numerics, actually obtaining things in two different ways. And so this is how we were able to then get strong evidence of conformal symmetry for the Ising models transition in 2+1D. And that's basically what I wanted to say for that. And yeah, thanks everyone for staying a bit late.
Thank you.